Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in. A good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. So, Helen, we always start by asking people, where are they and how are they?
Well, I'm sitting in South London. It's not term time in Cambridge at the moment, hence why I'm in London. I'm fine. Well, as fine as one can be in the way in which the world is at the moment, anyway. And I've been spending some time today doing another interview and trying to sort out my thoughts about Ukraine's energy history over the last 20 years or so.
Well, let's normally when we have political figures, you know, we ask them kind of to give us a kind of little potted history of their lives and what's kind of shaped them. I think that applies to an academic as well. You know, what's made you the kind of academic you are? What's been the things that have shaped you and your thinking? So we can understand a bit more about where you come from as we begin to unpack the book. And your thoughts?
Well, I think maybe the first thing to say is that I wasn't really sure that I wanted to be an academic. In fact, for quite some time, I didn't want to be, even when I was thinking about doing a PhD. So I didn't have any grand intellectual project, if you like, when I started my academic career. What I did do, and I think it has had long-term significance for me, was to do a PhD when I did decide that's what I wanted to do, on the Thatcher governments and the European exchange rate mechanism. So I was writing my PhD at the London School of Economics in on Black Wednesday in September 1992, which was in a way quite a spanner in the works. Because it meant for what I was doing, because it meant that the end that I had in mind was no longer, it could no longer be the end of my PhD. But I think the fact that I chose that as a topic, and which had some contingencies to it, but is also kind of explicable in terms of what I've been interested in as an undergraduate, was pretty significant, because it meant that I absorbed a lot about the whole setup of monetary union, about Britain's odd relationship to the European Union and being inside the European Union but outside monetary union, and all those debates in the 1990s about the great constraints of foreign exchange markets imposed upon countries. And in some ways, I think that what got me interested in the present things that now preoccupy me was really the way in which both the assumptions that dominated monetary policy in the 1990s, i.e. that everything was about price stability because there was a permanent risk of inflation, but that stopped being the world, I think, you know, around the time of the crash, the 2007-08 crash. And then the way that I saw it was that the beginning of the Eurozone crisis coming quite soon after that, pretty quickly, in my mind, destabilized the United Kingdom's membership of the European Union. So I've kind of really got into my present set of intellectual preoccupations, I think, by the crash, and both reawakening my interest in Britain's membership of the European Union and the monetary issues around that, and the fact that it just seemed such a seismic moment. And what then happened was, as I got re-engaged with these monetary questions, it dawned upon me that the shale energy boom, which I was paying some attention to, though I didn't have a serious interest in energy at that point, but I was noticing that it was happening, it kind of dawned on me that the only way in which this happened was the monetary environment that had been created by the crash, and it was dependent upon that credit environment. And it was out of that that I became as interested in energy as I was. So it didn't start with the geopolitics of it at all. What I realized, though, as I got interested in oil, was that if you didn't think geopolitically about it, you weren't going to get very far. So I tried to combine what I knew about, which was the monetary side of things, and the way in which I saw the crash having just transformed the monetary landscape, and what I needed to learn to get to grips with oil, which was about geopolitics. And then I found geopolitics pretty interesting. So I kind of carried on. I mean, I partly carried on because I realized that the more that you thought about it, the better able one was to understand the world in which we live. So it has its rewards, because suddenly things that seem quite, you know, difficult to understand become clearer. And I guess because I've always had a historical interest, in that sense, I've kind of, as a scholar of political economy, always wanted to be more historical than many people, I think. It came naturally to me to then start thinking about the geopolitical history of energy and to go backwards in time, as well as to try to understand the present, or to put it differently, that you understood the present by going backwards, understanding the past. And I think that probably if there's one thing being true about the way that I've approached trying to understand politics through my entire academic career, that's the consistent factor in it.
But that, what was interesting to me was the fact that, I mean, obviously you're quite technical. You write about technical issues, about monetary, financial, energy, policy, history, institutions, etc. You know, I mean, so in a sense, I mean, I understand politics through class, a bit through technology, you know, and that was what was so revealing to me about kind of different wiring about why what's happening today is happening. I mean, you know, were those things that just not of interest of you, or you just couldn't cover everything, or do you really, is your belief that what's going on now is largely driven by, you know, the intersection of energy and finance? We'll come into that and its role in democracy in a bit.
Well, one thing I would say is that I think I actually am quite interested in class. And I would say that actually class is a pretty important part, or at least it's a pretty important undercurrent of my argument through the democracy section of the book. I would say that actually, in terms of that conceptual language that I use about democratic excess and aristocratic excess, that underneath that is a set of assumptions that class does matter, or is an assumption that class really does matter. I think the thing that probably I take perhaps less seriously than I should, but also I would make a defense of my not including it, would be the technology issue. And I think that this is quite revealing in terms of, do we really think the modern world's driven by technology, or do we think the modern world was made by energy? And obviously the answer is both, but it does matter, I think, which one gives, you know, like primacy to. And I would give primacy, I mean, I would stand my ground on that, of giving primacy to energy over technology, simply because modern technology is largely dependent on energy. So even though technology can matter, if it hasn't got an energy foundation to it, and the energy resource base for it isn't secure, then technology can't function without energy. And I think that matters in terms of the optimism about the energy transition, because I think that there's a tendency to think that there are technological fixes to the energy transition without actually engaging with the problem of moving from high density energy to low density energy. And I think that there's a certain way of thinking about the end of the Cold War that puts a lot of importance on the technological supremacy of the West, its ability to technologically to innovate. And I think as a consequence of that, it underplays the importance of the Soviet Union's internal crisis around energy resources and energy exports in terms of how the Soviet Union came to an end. So I think that it's in that there's a certain kind of distortion, if you like, that enter our analysis if we really take technology out of the context of energy.
Yeah, I'm sure it's intertwined, and as ever, it's bloody complicated. Let's get into the book, and just what are your hopes for the book? What do you want it to do in terms of people's understanding? And then we'll go through it a bit more, yeah, so people get more of a flavour of it before they go and buy it.
Well, I started thinking about it in a book form, or the idea of writing such a book, I would say, in 2017. Though I didn't commit anything to an idea writing it down until 2018. And it was very much shaped by the events of 2016, what were taken to be the two big shocks, Brexit and Trump. But in my mind, it was always thinking about those shocks, the shock of the failed coup in Turkey in July 2016. And so my first impulse was simply to say that I thought that the shocks of 2016 had got a long history and were frequently being misunderstood, particularly Brexit and Trump, obviously, as very short-term phenomena driven by what was often called populist politics, as we know, and in some sense had a kind of the bad men of history narrative to it. So, you know, these things wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the awfulness of Johnson, Donald Trump, etc. And I just thought that that was wrong, and I wanted to explain why that I thought that what was going on in the 2010s, and particularly the second half of the 2010s, had a long structural history to it. So I wanted to try to understand the times in which we were living, as I understood that to be in the middle of the 2010s, and specifically, to say, the second half of it. Now, by the time I reached the end, obviously the pandemic had happened, but in some sense, the pandemic wasn't too difficult to fit into what I wanted to say, because I thought that the fallout of the pandemic reinforced a number of the stories that I was telling. What, though, happened in the summer of 2020 was, as I was trying to bring things to an end, to get to the end of the book, was a sense that actually I hadn't really taken seriously enough the relationship between the politics of the energy transition and the politics, including the geopolitics, of the fossil fuel energy story that I was telling. I'd kept them apart. I was just going to have a section at the end about the energy transition. And what dawned on me that summer of 2020 was that the energy transition, in terms of its fault lines, had a more continuous history with the fault lines around fossil fuel energy, and that I needed to have a more integrated story. And that if I didn't do that, then in some sense, I wasn't actually engaging with the times in which we were living, that the energy transition couldn't just be bolted onto the end of these histories. It had to be something where we were reaching this point as a central predicament, I think, of the times in which we live, and that in some sense the book had to have that as its narrative driving force as much as anything that happened in 2016.
So let's get into the kind of heart of it for kind of us at Compass, because the book is, you know, there are three sections. The first deals with energy, the history of energy, the place of energy, and particularly oil. The second bit looks at the financial markets, and particularly, you know, what happened around, you know, Brexit, as you say, the ERM, and the creation of the Eurozone. And then it goes into the implications of all of that for democracy. It challenged me because it made me feel a lot smaller, because there are these forces at work that are so big and so powerful and so long-term that it kind of made me feel diminished in terms of what we can do as actors in all of that. You know, we make history, but not in conditions of our choosing. I mean, have you always felt that in terms of our ability to shape the world? And if it isn't about great, you know, it's not about great men, you know, good or bad, you know, it really made me kind of begin to think about the place of democracy and actors and us as democratic actors. It's a tough picture you paint, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say two different things here. The first of all would be on the energy side. I think that once you really start to think about energy, it's quite hard to avoid taking a more structural view of historical change. So in that sense, from the point, which I would say was sometime in late 2013 into 2014, that I began to try to think about energy, my thinking became more structural. I think that that's certainly true. I think, though, on the democracy side, I would say that actually I am telling a story from which the starting place anyway is quite pro-democracy, in the sense that I wanted to show the ways in which I thought that, at least from the 90s, but particularly from longer than that, probably from some point in the 70s, so when the 70s conflicts have kind of resolved themselves in the balance of power in which that they do, that this had undermined democratic politics in ways that I think were, in significant part at least, avoidable. And so I would say, if you want to give an example where I would say, look, what happened in the democratic politics part of it really was consequential, and that didn't have to go the way in which it did, I would say the way in which the US during the Clinton years dealt with the integration of China into the World Trade. Well, actually, China didn't actually join the World Trade Organization until after Clinton left office, but the setup for China's integration on a permanent basis into the world economy on the trade side was done during the Clinton years. And what I wanted to bring out there was that actually, you know, you have a set of people who are making these decisions, the politicians, and they're being heavily influenced by the corporate interests that are being well served by China's integration into the World Trade Organization ultimately. What were being sacrificed were the interests of American manufacturing workers. And that wasn't just something that had to happen, I don't think. I don't think there's any absolute inevitability about that. And it came to have, it really did political damage to American democracy. And one part of the Trump story and Trump's ability to succeed so improbably in so many ways and become American president was because American politicians in that period were so cavalier, I think, about the distributional consequences of integrating China into the international economy. And I don't think the forces at work in the international economy at the time determined that.
So in the book, you introduced me to the concept of democratic excess, which was a kind of a debate and a kind of mood that developed in the 70s. Mm. Do you want to just tell kind of listeners about that? Because I found that really helpful in terms of understanding the level of kind of democratic backsliding that we've been experiencing kind of since then.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting here is this idea that I took from the ancient Greek historian Polybius, who was writing about the Roman Republic, and he said that basically each form of government is destroyed by its own excess. So democracies are destroyed by democratic excess, and aristocracies are destroyed by aristocratic excess. And I think that if you looked at, say, like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, we don't have any difficulty, particularly perhaps with the French Revolution, of understanding the role that excess played of that monarchical aristocratic form of government of the Ancien Régime in bringing it to its crisis. But I think that there's been a more reluctance to understand democracies in those terms, partly because there's a whole way of thinking about democracy that just assumes that somehow history's on its side as a form of government, and that once it's established, at least at a certain point of economic development, that it's going to last. I don't really think in those terms about democracies. I'm quite open to the idea that democracies can undo themselves in time in the same way in which other forms of government can. But then the question was for me, well, if that's right, if there's something in this, what kind of form, what form of government is representative democracy? Is it actually a democratic form of government, or is it an aristocratic form of government because it's the representative democracy and not a direct democracy? And my view is that it's both, that it's, it has democratic elements and it has, in these terms, aristocratic elements. But notably, I think the risks of aristocratic excess, of the concentration of wealth and power in too few hands, and the corruption around that in a representative democracy is, I think, greater than the risk of democratic excess of majoritarian dynamics that lead to the destruction, say, of property rights, or for would be one example. Now, if we then move to the 1970s, what struck me was is there was a whole critique of the governability of Western democracies that went on, particularly came out of that report from the Trilateral Commission, The Crisis of Democracy, that basically suggested that democracies were now too democratic. And the particular argument that was made in the 1970s by these people was that democracies were prone to producing inflation, that they produced excessive wage demands from organized labor that was too powerful, and governments had no incentive to say no to demands for increased public expenditure, and so that they became fiscally feckless. And those arguments were very consequential. I think that those arguments, in some sense, laid the foundation for the move to central bank independence, for saying, actually, we don't trust democratically elected politicians to make decisions about monetary policy. We need technocrats to do that. We need central bankers to do that. And they need to do that according to a fixed script. And that fixed script says the only thing that matters is being as anti-inflationary as possible, firm anti-inflationary discipline. The whole of the monetary union in the Maastricht Treaty was set up on that basis. But the problem is that it's not a very good account, I think, of what happened in the 1970s. Now, that's not to say that there weren't some powerful trade unions in the 1970s. If you say what was the ultimate cause of inflation, I think it was came from the energy shocks, and generally trade unions were responding to those energy shocks, and the ones that were able to demand higher wages succeeded in doing so, and the less powerful ones didn't. And that actually inflation came down in the 1980s when it did, because oil prices came down, and particularly they crashed in the middle of that. It crashed in the middle of that decade. So something got entrenched, I think, about saying that democracy was economically problematic and dangerous, that was wrong as a reading of what had happened in the 1970s. And then on the other side of it, I think that the reopening up of national economies in the West to financial flows across state borders, to open international flows, not just in terms of investment, but in terms of like foreign exchange markets, financial markets, the reemergence of international financial markets, the possibilities that that created for offshore tax havens, etc. All that started to make it pretty difficult for democratically elected politicians to do that much more in economic policy terms than respond to the incentives created by financial markets. And in the end, I think it made it more difficult for them to tax the rich, or at least the very, let's rephrase that, to tax the very rich. And it made it more difficult for democratically elected politicians in Western democracies to really use economic policy to sustain the idea that we were citizens of a nation, we were citizens of a national economy, and that certain rights, economic rights, came with that citizenship. Certain, I think, obligations came with that as well, of paying taxes, being willing to lend your savings to the democratic state. And I think that the consequences of all the this change, compounded by the way in which China's integration into the trading side of the international economy acted as a depressed wages and caused manufacturing job losses, particularly in the United States, was that it made it very difficult for elected politicians to be that responsive to democratic demands for redistribution in any way. And it made it more difficult for them to sustain an idea that there was a national economy for which the state would take responsibility, and that part of what the state was taking responsibility for was protecting its citizens from the ebbs and flows of that international economy. So what had become a way of defining nationhood through economic nationhood kind of didn't work any longer. And as it didn't work any longer, democratic politics became a lot harder. And in the language I started by using, we see many more of the problems of aristocratic excess arising around it. And the culmination of that, I think, is what happened in the United States, because on top of these other dynamics, you had corporations being able to exercise ever more influence over the outcome of elections by the amount of money that that individuals in these corporations could donate. And after 2010, that billionaires could simply, you know, write out huge checks for the candidates of their preference. So in the case of the United States, I think that we could talk about politics becoming pretty oligarchic in the 2010s, not just aristocratic excess, but actually moving away from some things that we would think of as quite fundamental in democratic politics.
To try and get some people primed up to ask some more questions. I mean, we've got, on the one hand, we've got this debate about democratic excess. On the other level, you've got democracy being actually hollowed out by globalization as power and politics is separated. And right at the beginning of the book, you have a line where you say Brexit was in the long term most likely unavoidable. So this wasn't just a campaign of Farage at the last minute, whatever. You're describing all of these pressures of distributional conflict between globalized, you know, elite needs, you know, and return to, you know, return to labor and the social wage. You know, that inevitability of Brexit was kind of being built in by all of that, by the Eurozone being run by technocrats, not being run in favor of people. So, you know, so it was, you feel, you know, that that means that Brexit was kind of, or something like it was going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the issues here where Brexit are concerned are twofold. I mean, the first of them was to do with the Eurozone crisis. Now, obviously, Britain wasn't in the Eurozone, so it didn't have to deal with the fallout of technocratic decision making during the Eurozone crisis. What it had to deal with was the fallout of the fallout, if you see what I mean, such that that position in which Britain had been inside the single market but outside the monetary union got destabilized on two fronts. I think it got destabilized by the fact that, for understandable reasons, the Eurozone authorities wanted to be able to regulate more the financial center of the Eurozone, which wasn't in any Eurozone country, but was in the United Kingdom. It was in the city of London. And for other understandable reasons, that David Cameron's government wanted to defend the city's interests against such regulation. And then what we see from really from 2012, once the UK economy is finally recovering from the recession caused by the 2007-8 shocks, crash, the Eurozone economy is back in recession again. And so we start seeing a quite significant uptake, at least from the British side, of migration from Southern Europe, the Eurozone countries that were most afflicted by the Eurozone crisis, into the United Kingdom. And that's the context, I think, in which UKIP's rise starts. So that's one set of economic dynamics that were going on. And the nature of the European Union meant that David Cameron found it incredibly difficult to do anything about either of those problems. In fact, each time I would say that he tried to do something, he simply demonstrated the UK's relative powerlessness in the European Union. I think the other story, though, is a bit different, which is this issue about how do you legitimate the constitutional treaties of the European Union? And for a period between Maastricht in 1991, when so the Maastricht summit being December 1991 and the Lisbon Treaty, which was finally ratified in 2009, the EU had a lot of treaties. It had Maastricht, it had Amsterdam, it had Nice, it had the Constitutional Treaty that didn't get ratified. It had Lisbon. And these were stacking up problems, I think, for in UK's democratic politics, because the argument that had been presented to the British electorate back in 1975 in the referendum on whether to leave then was that this is really just a free trade area, or at the very least, it's an economic arrangement. It doesn't have any constitutional implications. And I think that British politicians had thereafter been very reluctant to test out whether there was consent to any of these treaties that then happened from the 90s onwards in referendums, because they were pretty scared, I think, of what the outcome of such a referendum would be. So they would make arguments about the fact that these didn't have constitutional consequences. But this was pretty difficult when it got to the Constitutional Treaty itself, because it was called the Constitutional Treaty. And Blair, as we know, after considerable reluctance, had to give in and say that there would be a referendum. And he was supported in that by all the parties at the time. And then after the French and the Dutch voted the Constitutional Treaty down, then Blair was off the hook. And the problem was passed to Gordon Brown when the Constitutional Treaty got rewritten essentially as the Lisbon Treaty. And Brown, understanding the stakes, didn't want to put it to a referendum. But that meant, I think, that there was just this sense amongst enough British voters, and actually certainly within the Conservative Party, that something had been done that wasn't quite right, that a referendum had been promised and it hadn't been delivered. And Cameron tries to fix that problem, I think, tried to fix that problem by trying to have a new treaty, which could then he could then hold a referendum on. And if that was accepted in a referendum, then that would kind of like democratically reset Britain's consent, British democratic consent to the whole thing. But there wasn't going to be a new treaty, because other European Union governments were also very wary about treaties and referendums by this point. So Cameron was left not being able to pursue his preferred option. And I think that we can see then an element in which democratic demands to say, look, if we're going to keep having these treaties, we're going to have these effectively new constitutional rules at the EU level, there has to be some consent to it. That argument becomes pretty difficult to resist, and Cameron can't resist it. And out of that comes the of the referendum. So I would say that in a way, that attempt to try to keep consent to these treaties out of British politics was a bit aristocratic excess kind of politics. And then the politicians, well, Cameron has to give in to, okay, we will have a referendum on something. It's unfortunate from his point of view, it's on in-out membership. But interestingly, then we get this reaction in the other direction saying, well, look, actually, referendums are democratic excess politics, because they just let, you know, they give binary questions to electorates. They let demagogues make bad arguments. And then everything changes on a 52-48 vote. So you can really see, I think, through this Brexit issue, the whole tension between the problem of aristocratic excess in democratic politics and the problem of democratic excess.
And you tell the one, it's a wonderful story about those kind of deep kind of structural issues which are driving all this stuff. Let's just finish off from me before we hand over to Gabriel and questions from our members. If you were finishing off the book this week and you had to deal with prime ministerial fines and France, how would you weave both of those into your democracy story?
Well, I think in the French, I think I've got quite a robust story about France, in the sense that I think that these issues actually about constitutional treaties in the EU play a pretty big part in hollowing out French democracy. Sorry, I'm going to rephrase that, hollowing out the French party system. That at different points, the centre-right and the centre-left, the Socialist Party in France, really get hammered by these treaties. I'd say the centre-right initially by the Maastricht Treaty and the centre-left by the Constitutional Treaty. And what happens in France is that the parties that get labelled extremist become the ones that articulate Eurosceptic sentiments against all this, but they don't actually have a serious plan for how France can cope with what they would like, I think, in principle to happen, which would be France leaving the Eurozone. So what we see in France is that as the party system breaks down, at least at the centre, either the votes go to extremes like Le Pen to the right, or they go to a much more radical version of the left like Mélenchon, or they go onto the streets like the Gilets Jaunes. And what we have in the middle, so to speak, is Macron, who wants to, or ran for president in France the first time round on the basis of a personal movement. Yeah, he wanted to run outside the French party system because he understood the weakness of the Socialist Party, which is, you know, after all, he'd served in Hollande's government. But the very fact that he wanted to stand outside the party system to be president means that he weakened the party system. And that, as we've seen, the two central parties of the French Fifth Republic have just collapsed. I mean, you've got, you know, absurdly low levels of the votes. And I think actually that France is a much underestimated story of the 2010s. I mean, I think actually the two places where what happens in a Western democracy that in some sense are the most revealing for different reasons of France and Italy. I mean, Italy, because you have so many technocrats in, you know, government to the point where it seems the only person who can be, you know, prime minister of Italy is the former president of the European Central Bank. And France, because the party system is just the old party system is just gone. I think in terms of the fines, I mean, in terms of Johnson's problems is that, you know, it is an example that the problem he got himself into, where people in power think that there's one set of rules that they can impose upon the citizens, and that there's another set of rules that they can live by themselves. And that we saw, I think, some of those dynamics around the, you know, expenses, parliamentary expenses scandal, you know, around the same time as the crash. And in some sense, the very damaging thing, I think, for Johnson out of all this is that he tried through Brexit to be somebody who wasn't necessarily an anti-establishment politician as such, but he became a kind of rallying call for the "our votes as Leave voters must count" position. And that meant that he was like saying, well, what happens in Parliament is not more important than what the voters think. But actually, the way that he's behaved in relation to Partygate puts him pretty much in the same kind of position, where you say, actually, oh, well, they're just voters. We can apply the rules to them. It's okay if they can't go to, you know, a funeral, if they are put under, you know, intolerably difficult conditions because of pandemic rules, these don't apply to us. So I think that on the one side, it's a kind of only in a badly functioning democracy could I think that we have such indifference for the idea that the rules apply to everybody. I think that what we'll now see is, in a way, a kind of reaction against the criticism, not because of anything really to do with the UK's internal democratic politics, but the argument will be all this looks a little bit pedantic and fussy in the middle of a war when Ukraine is fighting for its future as an independent state and as an independent people, and the UK has been quite supportive compared to some, at least of Ukraine's position. And interestingly, if you go back to the 70s and this whole sort of democratic excess thesis, then one of the arguments that were made, particularly by American kind of thinkers of this kind, like say like Samuel Huntington, would be, oh, that what undermined the American position in Vietnam was American democratic politics. And so that sense of that actually voters should shut up, so to speak, when there's big geopolitical events going on, I think was part of the democratic excess thesis of the 1970s. I'm not saying that, I don't buy that actually argument in relation to Vietnam, but I think you can structure the kind of response that there will be to pressure to remove Johnson from office in those terms.
Fantastic. Gabriel, I've spoken too long. Over to you and proper questions.
Thanks, Neil, and thanks so much for that, Helen. Okay, we've got some great questions, and the first one comes from Inyong. Inyong, would you like to unmute yourself and put your question to Helen? Oh, sorry, I should say we're going to take a group of three, and then we'll come back to Helen for her answers.
Unmuted. Can you all hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Great stuff. Thank you for your interesting talk, Helen, and everyone for putting the event on. What I wanted to ask was, in a book, a really fascinating book I read called Why the West Rules for Now by Ian Morris, Ian makes an argument that throughout time, our ability to meet the energy demands of our society would ultimately decide whether or not that society would thrive or collapse. Now, it's long been considered that environmental security demanded a Green New Deal. But given that military security is now high on the agenda, could we see nuclear power, a nuclear New Deal, if you will, supplant ideas around a Green New Deal, given the sort of the likelihood of us seeing a potential, new arms race and recommitment to, those kinds of generators and the like. And if that was the case, what would this mean for the planet? And what would it mean for geopolitical stability?
Okay.
And the next one comes from Catherine Fitzgibbon. Catherine? Have we got you, Catherine? Would you like to unmute yourself and put your question to Helen?
Hello, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Yeah, sorry, I'm in my car. Following on actually from the last question it's been very clear that the energy industry, it's a huge, powerful industry and it has possibly been dominating, economics and politics for longer. But as we shift to renewables, and there really is a shift going to happen, and, the tipping point is almost there, How will those interests seek to capture and monopolise that sort of power back in energy creation? And, it made me think with that last question, is that why there's quite a push now on nuclear? Because in a way that's easier to take control of. Whereas renewables could shift the power to certain countries, particularly in the south, which have a lot more solar energy, etc. So I just wonder what you see with that dynamic.
Thanks, Catherine. And one more sort of energy-focused question in this round from Colin Miller. Colin?
Oh, hi. Sorry, I was drifting off. Yes, I was just wondering, you mentioned some of the kind of populist right-wing kind of backlash against globalism and so on. I was just wondering, to what extent do you think the mass movements around the climate crisis has shifted policy and the way in which the energy economy functions? Has it had any impact, or is it is there a larger forces going on?
Okay, let's start with nuclear. I think we were already seeing, actually, before the war in Ukraine started, so last autumn, when I would say the present energy crisis that we're dealing with really began, the war, I would say, has accentuated it deeply rather than caused it. So we saw last autumn, I think, the return of nuclear power as a divisive issue within the European Union in particular. So France led a group of 10 countries in writing to the European Commission and effectively pleading for nuclear power to be included as part of the EU's green taxonomy. And that's a position that's clearly rejected by Germany and by Austria as well. And it's noticeable, I think, that of all the U-turns that the German government has made over the last 6 weeks, and I would argue that the German government has upended 50 years of German foreign policy over the last 6 weeks. A U-turn on nuclear is not happened and doesn't look like it's forthcoming, will be forthcoming. That in Germany, the politics of anti-nuclear power run very deep. So I think that we're going to see a struggle within the European Union over what to do about this question. Now, I do actually think that it's possible, I won't go any further than that, that the ways in which nuclear-powered submarines have become more important militarily is also part of the explanation as to why nuclear power is coming back to the surface as an energy question. I think we could see the importance on the submarine side in the whole fury about Orsak and France's exclusion from that late summer. So I think that these energy questions and which energy source is used that does have some sort of military power implications well. Now, if we look at a bit of the history there of nuclear power, this won't be the first time that after a geopolitical crisis that Western countries or some Western countries have turned towards nuclear power. That was one of the reactions to the Suez Crisis back in 1956, not least actually in West Germany. And so before West Germany had a strong, the anti-nuclear power politics, had a very strong elite level pro-nuclear power politics. And it isn't just the safety issues that turned Germany, I think, away from that. It's also the financial issues, the costs around nuclear power. And we can see that in the history, I think, of nuclear power in Britain, where there was nothing like the same political resistance on environmental grounds to nuclear power as there was in Germany. So I expect to see a considerable contest in Yang over the next few years about whether nuclear power will be central to the EU's Green Deal and how far the proponents of nuclear power are able to get past the issues that have in some sense bedeviled, I think, the nuclear power industry thus far. I think in terms of the green energy transition, leaving nuclear power out of it, I think that what we can see are two things. First of all, that it is going to be very difficult on the electricity front to make renewables the basis of electricity systems without a decisive breakthrough on battery technology for storage. I don't doubt that that will one day come. The problem is that at the moment, nobody could have any clear idea about when it will come. And that, I think, at a time of great deal of concern about energy security will shape the decisions that are made about the way forward in the energy transition. Now, in terms of the impact of the energy transition geopolitically, I think that it's certainly the case that renewables and particularly solar power in parts of the global south have considerable potential, if the storage issue can be addressed, of strengthening the position of countries that have not only had to be energy dependent in different ways, but have had their energy resources exploited by Western powers. And I think that in lots of ways, European countries, particularly Northern European countries, are going to have more difficulties here because, as we know, we live on an island where the sun doesn't actually shine for that much of the year. We're more fortunate where wind is concerned. What will happen, though, geopolitically, is a contest about the supply chains around, which is already happening, around the supply chains around the metals that are necessary for the green energy transition. And here, China has established a very considerable advantage, both in terms of the extraction of metals within China itself and dominance of supply chains out of extracting those metals in other parts of the world, including some African and Latin American countries. And I think that's the vulnerability of the global South going forward, is that there will be a new round of resource competition, and they will be, their resources will be fought over in ways with some parallels to what happened with oil during the oil and gas during the course of the, particularly oil during the course of the 20th century. Now, I don't think that actually the competition for metals will be as destructive and intense as it was for oil, partly because the concentration of them, or the distribution of them, I should say, under the Earth's surface is probably not as concentrated as the deposits of oil and gas were and are. But I still think it's going to make life quite difficult for those countries that are subject to that resource competition between the dominant powers. I've just now lost my thought about the third question. Gabriel, can you just remind me of the third question again?
Yeah, absolutely. So Colin asked, to what extent do you think climate crises, mass movements had on shifting things in the context of energy policy and economics?
Yeah, sorry. I remember, so, thanks, Colin. Yeah. Well, one thing I think is really interesting is if you look at 2019, it's a really important year in where energy and climate are concerned. It's in 2019 where the British government becomes the first G7 country to legislate for a binding target for net zero by 2050. It's one of the last things that Theresa May's government does. The French government also passes the same kind of legislation as later in the year did Germany. The European Union commits at the collective level minus Poland to net zero by 2050. And if we say, well, how did this happen? Why did these governments change their position in such a short period of time? And if we add in the financial side of it, we see the rise of ESG investing that year as well. I think that the climate mass movement, which really, I would say, reached its peak in the first half of that year, played a pretty important part in that. It did change the political calculus facing Western governments in particular, because they saw that this wasn't a issue that was cared about, climate meaning the issue, that was cared about only by small numbers of people. Actually, the level of consciousness that people, large numbers of people had about the climate question by 2019 meant that they had very strong incentives to respond to it. Now, I don't think that those net zero commitments in terms of a strategy for achieving net zero by 2050 were particularly well thought out. In fact, I'd say they weren't really well thought out at all. But the dial moved, and it moved really considerably, because I don't think that you would have expected, even a couple of years ago, even perhaps in 2018, that governments would have made those kind of commitments. And if you think about it in the case of Britain, it's really quite extraordinary, given that Theresa May's government was, for obvious reasons, completely preoccupied by something else at the time. It was completely preoccupied by Brexit. It got no idea at that point whether UK was actually going to be leaving the European Union or not. But deep in Brexit politics, there was still sufficient awareness of the politics of climate change, the changing politics of climate change, for the Theresa May's government to say, we're going to act here. So I do think it made a difference.
One more quick one, Gabriel, from the membership.
Absolutely. Okay, so many to choose from. All right, let's go for Vicky Seddon. Vicky, would you like to unmute yourself and put your question to Helen? If you could keep it as short and snappy as possible, that would be much appreciated.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Just reflecting on current events, I thought the deals between the European countries and Russia around oil and gas were partly intended to tie Russia into not taking on European countries militarily, because Russia's own economic interests would then be compromised. But Putin seems to have just dismissed this. How come?
Okay. Do you want me to answer that one, Gabriel? No.
If you could just jump in, Helen, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, I think, Vicky, that the German government are probably asking themselves that question in a kind of nightmarish form, given that the last 30 years of German policy has been based on the notion that economic interdependence through such an important economic factor as energy would mean that Russia could not act in anything like the same destabilizing and military aggressive way as it has over the last 6 weeks. I think, though, that I don't want to say the writing was on the wall, because I think that's going too far. I still think there's something that's got to be explained about the decision that Putin made to launch this kind of war, this kind of comprehensive war against Ukraine. But if we look at it in energy terms, from Russia's point of view, until this, let's say from the point of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, is that Russia had a problem. And that was, is that the inheritance it had from the Soviet economy was that its principal exports were going to be oil and gas. And its principal customers, in fact, in the 90s, really its only customers, were going to be European countries. And in the Soviet era, when the Western European energy dependency on then Soviet Union, now Russia, began, the pipelines that took that oil and gas from the Soviet Union to, let's say, Germany, they ran through the whole of the Soviet Union. They came out in Poland and then they went into Germany. But with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the creation of independent states, on the western side of Russia, so Belarus, Moldavia, and most importantly, Ukraine, those pipelines went through those countries, and in particular that they went through Ukraine. And from the Russian point of view, that was always something that was pretty much unacceptable, was it, because it meant that they didn't control the transit of their most important exports. So I think that, and you can see this from before Putin came to power, so you can see it from Russian governments in the 1990s, that they always had some reason to push against the territorial settlement that emerged out of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The idea that energy interdependence was going to be something that was peaceful in relations between Germany and the states lying between Germany and Russia, and Russia, seemed to me to have been an illusion, because it was the very political problems that transit of those energy exports caused Russia that gave it some incentive to try to redo Russia's borders. So I think once we got away from the if you like, liberal idea that economic interdependence brings peace, and tried to think about it in more specific terms, about what was that specific economic interdependence, what geopolitical issues arose from it, we would have reached the conclusion that this wasn't the path to peace. And as I say, I'm not saying that because I think that that's a sufficient explanation for what Putin has done. I'm just trying to say I don't think that the energy relationship was stable. It had geopolitical vulnerabilities attached to it from the beginning, and ones that meant that Russia was likely to be a risk taker, I would say, where its borders were concerned.
Fabulous. Thanks for that question, Vicky, and all the other questions. Just one really final, hopefully quick answer, Helen, because we're just slightly over time, but it's been fantastic and fascinating. You know, will there be an age of order again? And isn't that always about deeper democracy versus aristocratic or kind of popular authoritarian democracy and the clash between those two things?
I think I'm not going to say there'll never be an age of order again. I think that we'll be living in the age of disorder for some time. And I think that the dynamics of like excess, reactions against excess, that they're not going to go away. But that's some reason for optimism, because aristocratic excess will in time, I think, you know, exhaust itself sufficiently that we'll be moving off in the other direction. When that is, I'm not going to say.
No crystal ball. Anyway, thanks very much, Helen. That was fantastic. So this is a deep, thoughtful and considered book, and I strongly recommend it to everyone. A Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century. Thanks so much, Helen. The next podcast will be in 2 weeks' time, 6 o'clock, Tuesday, the 26th of April, when Francis will be talking about France, and we'll have some distinguished guests to try and unpick what's happened in the second round, building on what Helen's been talking about after the first round this week, the implications for French politics, progressive fragmentation, and the future of Europe. Until then, thanks again, Helen. Thanks again to all of our members on the call tonight. If you haven't joined us yet, if you're listening in, please do so. We need you in this age of disorder, just as you need Compass. And please, as ever, everyone, keep safe, keep hopeful. Until next time, good night. So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore Compass, or Compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.